Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Truth and Movies. It's a special in one year, out the other edition, as with 2017 in the can, Team Truth and Movies celebrate the best of the year's cinematic output with our films of the year. Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Yeah, welcome everybody. And a particularly packed edition of Truth and Movies today. We have David Jenkins.
Hi there.
We have Hannah Woodhead.
Hi.
We have Adam Woodwood.
Hello.
And we also have a very special guest, Edgar Wright.
Hello. I feel like I should be a Woodwright or something.
Yeah, that would work. Edgar, it's so marvellous to have you here with us, out of Hollywood and that. Do you usually drop in on film review podcast things?
I mean, I've done podcasts before.
Yeah.
It's not a completely alien concept to me.
All right.
I think so. I mean, not maybe in terms of reviewing lots of other things, but I have not done this podcast before, that's for
sure.
That's
certainly true. It's kind of crossing a line, isn't it? Because you've got the filmmakers and then you've got the people who shoot them down.
I know. If you start slagging off films that, by friends of mine, I might go quiet.
Right.
If you think Edgar Wright went quiet, it's because he knows that person.
Yeah. Of course, there's one of your films is actually kind of within our pool of selection this year.
Could that get embarrassing?
We'll see. We'll see, because we're all going to nominate, basically, I think, two films of the year, which we managed to dovetail quite nicely. Nobody's picked the same as anybody else. I believe I'm going to start, and I'm going to start with Get Out, which I'm amazed that nobody else had on their list, because it's just an extraordinary...
I had it on my list, but I was told that somebody else was doing it.
It's so. Almost like we planned it.
Why was it on your list, Edgar?
Well, full disclosure, Jordan is a friend of mine. However... It's funny, I saw the film and it was an extraordinary thing because I had sort of three different phases of like enjoyment about that, because the first time I heard about it was he told me about it over lunch because he wanted to pick my brains. He said, can we get lunch because I want to pick your brains because I'm doing my directorial debut, and he wanted me to break down my shooting plan for the bathroom fight in The World's End, which I did. And then he told me what the film was basically about, and he said, oh, it's like a Stepford Wives or Invasion of the Body Snatchers, but about race. And, and I said, oh, are you going to be in it? I assumed he was going to be in it. He goes, no, I'm just directing. And I said, oh, this is great. You know, so this is interesting. And then I saw the movie before it came out with a preview audience, and it was an amazing screening. But I remember coming away, and I told Jordan afterwards that I loved it. I remember coming away thinking, I have no idea how that movie's going to do.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, it's an uncomfortable film to watch. And it's very enjoyable, but it's also, you know, it's uncomfortable in terms of its kind of themes and even the satire. And that's one of the things that makes it electric to watch with an audience, is because it is so sort of unflinching and savage in its kind of satire. It could either sort of like, you know, do really well critically, but like be too kind of uncomfortable for audiences, or it could do really well. And I think it then went like beyond that. It was sort of like it outgrossed like King Kong, you know. It made like 170 million
wow.
in the United States on a 5 million budget, which immediately makes it one of the biggest sort of profit makers of all time. It's kind of incredible. And actually, I just watched it again for the second time, and I think it really holds up on a second watch.
Okay.
Yeah, it's great.
For anyone who hasn't seen it, without giving too much away, it's all about a young African-American who meets with his white girlfriend's parents for a weekend in their secluded estate in the woods. Things then take a very dark and bizarre turn. it's a film that certainly blindsided me. I didn't have the benefit of a Lunch with Jordan Peele beforehand. I thought I was just watching a horror film, and I was greatly relieved to find that it wasn't really that scary a movie. But it does really shock you in so many ways. And interesting you mentioned The Stepford Wives, because there's obviously that. I thought They Live as well was something it reminded me of, because that whole thing of marrying horror and some kind of social commentary. When Jordan described it to you, did he describe it as a comedy, as a horror film, or what exactly?
I had met him a number of times, like through comedy, because obviously he was part of Key and Peele, who were a big double act. But you could see even in that show that he had a real love for film. And in fact, I think the first sketch on that show that I really like sort of connected with me was the Key and Peele playing the valets. I don't know if you've ever seen that sort of sketch where they're the action movie obsessed valets. So it was clear, even just meeting Jordan for the first time, that he was a major like film nerd. And then when we started talking, I didn't realize what a big horror fan he was. And that obviously is something that, like, you know, his whole reason for making the film is he thought that black horror fans had been massively underserved,
right?
You know, as an audience, because, you know, that audience shows up for horror movies, but there's not that many horror movies with a black lead.
Mm. You know? Although Night of the Living Dead, which we covered in Film Club a while ago.
That's funny enough, when I saw the movie, I tweeted about it. And this is something you do with your friends who are directors, is like you say, I'm going to tweet about the movie. When would be the best time to tweet? Do you want me to tweet right now, or do you want me to tweet the night before it comes out?
Right.
And I think like a couple of days later, Jordan texted me, said, tweet now. Like that. And so I said something about Get Out. And Get Out is a film that makes you jump and think. And I said, Dwayne Jones would be very proud. Mm. Dwayne Jones is obviously the lead of Night of the Living Dead. The other good film with a horror movie that I really like in a similar sort of way is Wes Craven's People Under the Stairs.
Oh.
Which, if you haven't seen that movie...
I haven't seen that one.
It's really good. I think it is actually his best movie. And that's another one that has like sort of is a horror movie, but also political, social satire at the same time.
Have you seen that, David?
You know what? I haven't seen that one. No.
Right.
You know what, guys? Just let's stop doing this podcast right now and go watch it. But I highly recommend The People Under the Stairs from 1991, I think.
All right. Get Out.
It's interesting what you're saying about him being a big horror nut and a film, you know, his film knowledge, because I watched it for a second time and there's so many little Easter eggs and things. There's a scene where Chris's friend is at the airport and the flight announcement comes over and it's the room from The Shining.
Right.
The flight number. And there's loads of little nice bits like that which I didn't pick up on the first time around. But yeah, it's definitely one that has a lot of rewatch value, I think.
Yeah.
I remember seeing it in the cinema and I can't remember this happening before, but there were people like doubled over laughing, like falling off their seat and screaming at the same time in shock.
I mean, it's Transformers. I had that in.
Oh, okay. How you can make a film that hits those two poles simultaneously seems like an incredible feat.
Especially when you've done a bit of genre hopping as well. What I also loved about this film was the title. I mean, it's one of the great movie titles, and it's funny how people get titles wrong. Is it the director that decides, or is it the studio, or is it some kind of marketing kind of process? How do they arrive at a title?
Well, it depends if you've written it as well. I mean, if you're a writer-director, then you pick the title. You know, certainly there are things where the studio will want to change the title. If you're not like the writer-director, you might not be completely in control of that.
Right.
So,
Hot Fuzz, was that your name?
It was.
Bingo.
You know what's funny, though, is that originally, and Simon Pegg didn't like it, originally I had it spelled with two T's, and he used to drive Simon crazy. And then eventually he said, please, can we drop the second T? And I said, all right. But funny enough, there's a funny thing about that was we had already like test screened it in the UK, and it had done very well in the UK, like the test screenings. And we did a test screening in the States, and the film tested really well, but usually sometimes with the studios, they have some ulterior motive for testing it. And they usually spring this kind of like their secret agenda within the focus group. And what I was not aware of was that they didn't like the title and they were confused about it. So suddenly in the focus group, the NRG person, that's the kind of research group that do all these test screenings, said, and what do we think about the title? What did the title Hot Fuzz mean to you? And I was sitting in the back and there was like these, you know, kind of like old American ladies going, well, hot fire, I don't know what that means. Is that a British expression? And I was like, at the back, I was like, and fuzz is the name from the 20s. The police used to call, you know, and you know where the fuzz comes from? Do you know where it actually comes from?
No.
In like the turn of the century, most of the police in New York were Irish and they all had moustaches and beards. So it's because they had face fuzz.
It's so it's such an American
here come
term.
The fuzz.
Isn't it?
It is an American term, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, because there's a movie, there's movies like Fuzz with Burt Reynolds from the 70s.
Right.
And also Super Fuzz. It is an American expression.
Right.
But it comes from the fact that the New York Irish police
had facial hair.
I've really digressed. I've really thrown your podcast off several times already. I'm sorry.
Unlike screening groups, we don't have an agenda. But great titles, though. I thought Baby Driver was a pretty good one. Did you have an exclamation mark on that or not?
No.
Oh, it's a shame.
That's Mother.
Yeah. Baby Driver, which is my other film of the year.
Thank you.
It would have been Paddington 2, but Paul King couldn't make it in today. No, but I enjoy lots of things.
Say that, Paul King.
And but with Paddington 2, can I just throw in, was a wonderful film. Left me really glowing for days afterwards. But most of all, like going to the cinema to enjoy myself. And I don't think there's another film that gave me as much enjoyment this year as Baby Driver. It was absolutely wonderful. Also because the premise, the cast, the kind of elements you were bringing in, I mean, the amount of ambition there was in this, of essentially making a musical, I've seen it described as Pulp Fiction meets La La Land. So often you hear about stuff like this and it just doesn't quite come off, or it's too self-consciously trying to create something. But this played true from really the word go. Are you surprised at how successful it was? This was a project you'd nursed for how long?
I literally had the first germ of the idea like 22 years ago when I was like 21. I remember specifically I was living in Wood Green and I was listening a lot to the John Spencer Blues Explosion because that album had just come out. And so when I used to listen to that song, Bell Bottoms, that opens the movie, I used to sort of imagine this car chase. And then, you know, over the years, I sort of tried to think of what the movie was that would start with that scene. And then that started to turn into the idea of the driver playing the music and the driver needing to have the music on the entire time. And then sort of it just kept sort of like developing, like, you know, in my head, you know. So it's been something that I've been thinking about for so long. But I didn't really have any idea how it would do. I think when you're actually making a movie, all that you're worried about is like, will it make back enough money for me to do another film?
Has it done?
It did fantastic. Like, I mean, it's not my biggest film in the UK. That is still Hot Fuzz, my second biggest film in the UK. But in the States, it outgrossed all of my other movies put together, which was really nice. And it also made back its budget like five times over, so that's also nice.
What is the level that is considered like pat on the back, good job?
Well, they're supposed to, the studio math that they do, which is slightly alarming, so you're supposed to sort of make back three times your budget. That's when you're fully in the black. But it did well. I mean, I feel very like happy because it was, these are exactly the kind of movies I grew up on. But sort of Hollywood, for the most part, have stopped making like mid-budget movies. They're either making like tiny budget movies like Get Out, or they're making like 250 300 million movies like Justice League.
Yeah.
And the sort of the ones in the middle, the films that I grew up on, don't get made so much anymore. So
why is that, do you think?
Because I think studios just have sort of put way too much of their energy into doing the franchise films.
Right.
And then the mid-budget films are sort of treated like side bets, if that. I mean, I think there's sort of like there's such a franchise mentality. Something that's just like a one-off film, in their minds, and I think they're wrong, it's almost like, well, why would we bother making this film that like
has no franchise potential?
Because
it's not like just mid-sized sort of movies, it's like original movies, basically.
Yes. But the irony is that when you do get those movies, sometimes they can completely clean up, you know, so I don't know. It's a shame because it sort of, it seems to me it would be, you know, you have more chance of having sort of bigger hits with films that don't cost 200 million, you know. So I was very pleased that it did well because it felt like suddenly, beyond even just me, it felt like there was a lot of other things riding on it. Because there's that thing when movies come out that if it's an original movie or something that's not a franchise, and it doesn't do well, you'll have like somebody at one of the trade magazines saying, audiences don't want to see original movies. So you think you have so much riding on your one film that they tend to, like, every Monday when the box office, like, sort of reports come out, that they then, like, sort of, like, judge the future of all movies on the success of one, you know.
Well, thank goodness it worked out. And this is, anyway, the story of Baby, who is a getaway driver who wants to get out of the game but is drawn back in, brilliantly enough, and let's twist this, for one last job.
I know. Have you ever heard that one before?
If you haven't seen it, you really should. Have you? How many times have you seen it back? Do you rewatch stuff after it's kind of been put out?
You know, you watch it a lot when you're editing it, and then you do test screenings. I think I did 3 test screenings. And then I think, you know, when you're doing the mix and stuff, you watch it a whole bunch of times. So I've seen it several times. In terms of actually, have I seen it with a paying audience? I don't think I have. No. I think I saw it at like 3 different premieres during the press tour.
Right.
And usually it would be on the basis of whether the cinema was good. Like, I think the last time I watched it all the way through was me and Ansel Elgort watched it together in New Zealand at the Embassy Theatre, because it was like the largest screen in the Southern Hemisphere.
Wow.
And I said, we should watch it tonight because this is a really good screen.
What's the bit you're happiest with about it when you watch it back? Is there something in particular that you think, yeah, I nailed that?
There are several moments in the movie that I like, sort of just like, is exactly what I had in my head. And then sometimes more so. You know, that's the great thing about working with other collaborators, not just actors, but also crew members, where, you know, they elevate what you've done on the page, or they elevate like what, you know, you had in your head. And sometimes that can be an actor. Like, I don't think when I wrote the script I ever thought I would have somebody like Jamie Foxx playing that part. And he kind of like just kind of brings it to sort of like a amazing life, that like a better movie star than I could ever hoped in that part. And there are sometimes with sort of like the sort of choreography and the music and the stunts all coming together. Like, I think one of my favorite bits in the movie is the whole section that has Blur's intermission going into Hocus Pocus by Focus, which feels like sort of like my music geekery sort of crash landing against my sort of action movie.
It's like, almost two casts to the film, because you've got an amazing lineup of actors, but the music's as big a part of this, and the selection of tracks that you have, which is eclectic but also electric, I would suggest. Oh, it's a fact. I you know, I could ramble on about this for ages, and I know you've all got films that you want to nominate. Adam,
I feel like I've really shanghaied this podcast.
No. I actually had a question on the soundtrack. I was listening to it on my way in today. I haven't seen the film again since it came out, but I could immediately imagine the scenes when I heard the songs. And yeah, I just wondered your process on that. I remember speaking to James Gunn for Guardians of the Galaxy, and he was saying about how he, you know, got this amazing mega playlist together and then sort of whittled it down and had an idea of like what songs would work for what scenes. And how did you do that?
Before I started writing, I had maybe like 10 of them worked out. And usually they're all songs that I love, but they're all songs that have something interesting going on. So, like, Hocus Pocus is a good example, because that has a really dramatic sort of, like, stop-start rhythm to it. So even just listening to that song, I was like, okay, this is like a running scene. Okay, this is going to be a foot chase. And, like, he's running with the guitars, and then there's, like, a breakdown. Okay, now he's hiding. Okay, now the guitar start up. Now he's running again. Sometimes I would let the song, like, lead me. So I would literally, like, when I was starting writing, I would, like, listen to the song with my eyes closed and have a piece of paper, and I would just, like, sort of, like, count how many like moments there were in the film, and I literally then look at the piece of paper afterwards and I think, okay, so there's like 20 beats in there, and then I go through again and like work out where those things were and start writing the scene around it. And then some other times when I was I knew what the plot was, but if I got to a scene where I didn't have a song, I would down tools and I would like find the song before I started writing again, and then I would just listen to that song over and over again. Like, there's that scene in the diner when he first meets Deborah where it has the Beach Boys instrumental, Let's Go Away for a While. You know, I found that, like, sort of when I was, like, trying to write the scene, and then I wrote the scene to that, like, song on a loop. So they've all got to be songs that you really like, because you're going to hear them hundreds of times. And in fact, there was one song that I did, like, get rid of because I started to get sick of it in the edit. And I figured out a way. We actually did a little bit of reshoots, and I reshot part of a scene so I could put a different song in, because I'd sort of got sick of this other song.
What was the other song?
I don't really want to say, because it was... I could say. I do like it. It was Nut Rocker by Bee Bumble and the Stingers, which at one point was in the movie. And then at a certain point in the edit, after having seen it like 80 times, I was like, I think I'm done with this song. But maybe it'll turn up in a future one.
All right, well, what is your next film, by the way?
That is still being deliberated. I'm reading a bunch of stuff and writing stuff, and the studio want me to do a sequel.
I don't think to Baby Driver?
It's been asked for, so it could happen.
Okay. All right. Hannah, were you a fan of Baby Driver?
I loved it. It was a bit of a weird one for me because I kind of thought I'd missed it at the cinema, and then I couldn't sleep one night, so I went to Westfield Stratford at 11 o'clock at night and it was playing.
Nice.
I was like, okay, I'm going to do this. And there were four other people in the cinema, which is like my favourite kind of time to go, you know, when no one else is there. And everyone like was like laughing, like enjoying themselves. And I was like, this is a really like bizarre to be sat with these four other people having this sort of experience. Like from the first second, you know, the kind of the bell bombs kicks in, it was just totally transported me. It was really great, yeah.
Oh, nice one. A joyride.
Yeah.
Yeah. Our top films of 2017 will continue after this. Adam Woodward. Films of the year.
On the spot.
Yeah.
These aren't necessarily my two favourite films of the year.
Okay.
But they're ones that I really liked at the time and kind of want to revisit at some point. The first one's the documentary, which is on Netflix, called Icarus, which I'm sure not many people have seen. It's one of those Netflix films that kind of came out with virtually no fanfare, and you know, there's not really any reviews of it online or anything. But it's interesting. It's on the surface, it's got a lot of things in it that I like. It's basically about doping in professional sport, specifically cycling.
Right. This is Brian Fogel's documentary.
So Brian Fogel is an amateur cyclist. He kind of introduces the film, where it opens up with him kind of telling the story of how he's competing in these sort of non-professional, like Tour de France style events, and not really getting anywhere, and decides to put himself on a doping program just to see how much it would actually enhance his performance.
Oh, like Supersize Me, but with gear.
Yeah, it's kind of got that vibe, actually. And it's one of those films that it starts off as one thing and just becomes something completely different, and he goes down this insane rabbit hole. He basically gets put in touch with a guy who is involved in Russia's kind of state-funded doping program. It's all happening around the time that story was exploding, and he has this insane like access to this guy.
This is Grigory Rodchenkov.
Yeah, yeah. I'm glad you took that.
No, who's since become a major figure in the kind of exposure of the state-sponsored doping in Russia.
It's a fascinating story, and it's just also really interesting, like from a journalistic point of view. He sort of takes on the mantle of, okay, I've got this thing here and I need to like nurture it and do something with it. And also he's built up this relationship and this rapport with this guy. He doesn't basically want to throw the guy under the bus. He's quite sensitive about how he like handles that, and it's just very fascinating. It's sort of like Catfish level of like, wow, this is just going somewhere that I didn't expect.
I saw it at the Sheffield Dockfest, and yeah, I mean, you know, to sort of emphasise the sort of power of journalism and how it can affect the sort of powers that be, the director was there and he did a Q&A, and the person from the festival was sort of asking him questions, and then on the sidelines there were these two like literally the biggest people I've ever seen in like tan suits and aviator shades with their arms folded, like looking out at the audience. He just had these two giant bodyguards walking around anywhere. He was having a coffee in the cafe and these two bodyguards were like around him because, you know.
It was the same, I saw it at BAFTA and exactly the same thing happened. Yeah, this poor guy now has got...
Do you have bodyguards, Edgar?
You do when you go to some countries, like, that you have to have bodyguards. It's kind of a strange experience. I don't have any bodyguards in London. But you do when you go to Mexico or like sort of Japan or China.
Japan, really?
Yeah. I mean, usually the studio put them on. I did have one experience where I had a bit of a panic attack in South Korea because I had 1.4 bodyguards.
That's too many.
It was too many and I couldn't handle it. And I had to sort of like it was very strange. Like sort of I got to South Korea, which was otherwise amazing and I had a great time. But I got there and I was trying to go out for something, a bite to eat at 10:30 at night on a Sunday. And I suddenly was like, I had like four bodyguards from the studio. And I went into this restaurant. I was so embarrassed that I had these people with me that I had to leave immediately and go back to the hotel. And then the next morning, I would like sort of was supposed to go to the gym and see a trainer like at 7 a.m. The story is already embarrassing. It's about to get worse. And at 5 to 7, there's a knock on my hotel room door. And it was the handler from the studio. I said, oh, is everything okay? He goes, yes, we're here to take you to the gym. And I looked around and the two bodyguards were there. And I said, I don't need bodyguards to go to the gym. And they said, well, they've been booked. And I was like, oh. So I had this very like cringy, embarrassing thing of like being, you know, marched through a Korean hotel with like two bodyguards to go to the gym. It's already embarrassing just being in your gym gear, but yeah, not with like two bodyguards.
Well, doing stuff in front of people, especially...
No.
No?
I mean, no, absolutely. It's embarrassing. Right, yeah, absolutely.
Because they're presumably quite athletic people. So you just feel a little bit more
standing
pressure.
Standing there judging you.
Yeah. Anyway.
I didn't let them walk me into the gym. We got to the door of the gym. I said, now I'm going in on my own. Sorry.
I haven't seen Icarus yet, but I intend to at the first opportunity.
I think it's still on Netflix, so give it a watch. Mm. My second one.
Your second film is?
A Ghost Story, which we've covered on this pod before. And we had David Lowery on actually talking about that. And yeah, it's just one of the most, I think, original and beautiful films I've seen this year. One that I didn't know what to make of so much at the time and then has really stuck with me.
Yeah. A singular exploration of legacy, love, loss and the enormity of existence. A recently deceased white-sheeted ghost returns to his suburban home to reconnect with his bereft wife. Disappointingly, they don't make pottery together. That was one of my notes about
But there's
film.
A great pie scene, so that makes up for it.
We were talking before about films that you don't get the first time, and I really didn't understand what I was meant to be doing with this film the first time, because it's a totally different approach to making cinema than you would normally see.
You know, he's obviously not making something super commercial, and it's quite freeform in its sort of structure and the way it introduces and develops certain ideas, but especially its kind of idea of time, the way it like plays with that is not as you would expect. He's an interesting director. I think he could be making, like, I mean, he made Pete's Dragon with Disney. He could quite easily be doing that, and it's nice to see him doing a bit of both.
Well, I think Peter Pan, he's doing a live action Peter Pan up next. Have you seen A Ghost Story?
No, I haven't. I've been meaning to, actually, because I liked I didn't see Pete's Dragon, but I liked his previous movie, An Embodied Saint. And he's also an editor, or he's an ex-editor, David Lowery, isn't he?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
But I saw the trailer for A Ghost Story, and it was like seemed like it was, you know, sort of up my alley. And I was away when it was at the cinema, so I've been meaning to watch it. It looks great.
Hmm. David, you're a fan?
Yeah, I guess I'm a similar boat to yourself. I was a bit baffled by it when I saw it at the cinema. Wasn't sure what it was getting at, really. But it is definitely one I want to give another go to.
Yeah.
And it was really, I think it's really interesting. It felt more like a kind of, like, the sort of experimental film you gets made in like Asia rather than like UK. It had a kind of like dreamy bucolic quality to it that you don't get from American films, really.
It's always, I think, a point Dave Lowery was making, it's almost like an installation that you observe, a bit like, or narrative structure, but it's kind of been freed from that by the death of a protagonist. Well, great choice, Adam. Who's up next? Hannah?
Yeah, I'll go next.
All right, we'll hear your choices after this.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hannah Woodhead, your choices for films of the year.
So I've chosen two very different films, but they both begin with G. So we have God's Own Country and Good Time.
Ah.
These are both like films that I kind of didn't really know much about going into and then had like the best time. I came out of God's Own Country like in tears. It's very emotional. And Good Time I missed completely and then saw it last week. And I was like, oh my God, this is like the best thing I've seen all year. How did I miss this? So, I think very, very different films, but both incredibly worth your time.
Good Time is an amazing film, isn't it?
Yeah, I know you guys talked about it on the pod, but it just passed everyone by because it was released for about a week in cinemas on 8 sites across the UK, which is like nothing. And then it's gone on to Curzon Home Video. It's coming out on Blu-ray in the new year over here. But yeah, it kind of just passed everyone by, which is such a shame. It's brilliant, like beautifully shot film, the Safdie brothers. And Robert Pattinson, who of course is, you know, Twilight and Harry Potter alumni, gives this like powerhouse performance. It's like really difficult performance as this con man who's trying to get like help his brother get out of prison. And yeah, it was just everything came together so spectacularly. It kind of blindsided me. Like the music is like some of the best, not even in just film, like I've heard all year. And yeah, it's, I would say like go and watch it straight away, especially Christmas. Perfect family viewing, Boxing Day, you know. Get Good Time on the on demand.
It's a really intense film, isn't it? From the very start, it
yeah,
kind of
yeah,
whacks it straight up to 10 and keeps going.
Yeah, it's like been hit in the face repeatedly, but like nice. In a nice way, you know. Yeah. It's sort of
pillow.
Unrelenting. Yeah.
I think that this year, actually, I just want to chime in and say Robert Pattinson has, like, in 2017, I think, become, like, one of the greats. I mean, he's astonishing in the lead in Good Time. He's kind of channeling De Niro in Mean Streets, you know, just that relentless hustle. And also, he's incredible in the film Lost City of Zed, where he plays a sort of supporting role.
Mm.
And it's this quite kind of, like, retiring, gaunt figure. It's like he's channeling John Hurt. It's just this astonishing in-the-background performance that he's really not trying to sort of take the limelight in this film, which is kind of, you know, Charlie Hunnam is the main character in it. In the background, he just, you're kind of relentlessly drawn to him. He is, like, astonishing. I can't wait to see what he does next.
Oh, yeah. He's, certainly he's brilliant in this, but an amazing film and really different rhythm, should we say, to God's Own Country. Edgar, have you seen Good Time?
Yeah, I liked it a lot. The Safdie brothers, I saw one of their previous movies, Daddy Long Legs. And in fact, I was on the Independent Spirits jury that year, and we gave it, I think we gave it a couple of awards, or we definitely nominated it for a couple of things. Because what's one of the co-writers' name, their friend Ronald Bronfman, I think?
Yeah, he's in the film.
Yeah, and yeah. He's the star of Daddy Long Legs.
Yeah.
And I remember the Independent Spirits we ended up giving him, he got nominated for Best Actor that year, along with the movie. But I think one of the things that they do really well is that you never get a sense that there's a crew there at all. They're so good at shooting cities. And when I was watching that movie, I felt like, I think it seems like there's not a single scene where they have location permits. It feels like they're just like shooting on the streets with those actors. I don't know whether that's true, but in the two films I've seen of theirs, Daddy Long Legs and Good Time, it feels like this is the city represented very naturalistically, and you never get the sense that you're watching like a movie.
Mm.
And they're really good at doing the grime and grit of like the sort of urban areas. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah. We've actually got an interview with them on that very subject,
yeah,
where they're talking about the idea of, for them, living in a city is bumping into people,
yeah,
and that's kind of like anathema to movie making because
yeah,
you have to, it's a very kind of controlled environment, and that is what they go for. They have permits, but they let people walk into the frame, and
right,
they sort of let the sort of natural hum of the area persist while they're shooting.
That normally, do you let passers-by come through, is it a very strictly controlled street scene?
Usually, you do have to kind of like hold people, but usually it's two things. Is like, if you've got lots of money, you could kind of close a street down. But usually how it's done is that you have like PAs who are just asking people politely not to walk through a shot. In Shaun of the Dead, there's that scene where he walks from his house to the corner shop and back, all in one Steadicam shot, which we shot in Crouch End. Now, we're a low-budget film doing that, so all you can do, even as you traverse like three blocks, is have PAs hiding around the corners, like trying to hold people. And I remember we did like maybe like 8 takes of that shot. But one of the takes, which we'd nearly finished, Simon Pegg is almost back to his house. This drunk guy walks through the end of shot and goes, "F you guys!" Like that. And it was like, ah! And it was like, because the PA is not allowed to touch somebody.
Right.
You have to say, "Oh, please, could you just stand there? Just be 30 seconds, please." Yeah, I mean, similar thing actually in Baby Driver, that shot where he goes to get coffees. Mm-hmm. The opening sequence, which again goes through like 3 city blocks. We had not all of the streets closed. So out of the corner of every frame is like an army of PAs stopping cars and trying to stop people walking through. I think it would be, you know, very different from a Good Time where that makes total sense that they would try and sort of create the kind of the busyness of it. In the Baby Driver shot, you know, it's all so choreographed that you don't want a member of the public to come through. And sometimes I've had a thing where, like, there's somebody gawking at the camera who's, like, looking right down the barrel of the camera, and it's right in the middle of, like, an otherwise great shot, and it's like, let's digitally remove that person.
Yeah, no.
Let's get rid of that person.
Yeah. So, Hannah, tell us a little bit about God's Own Country, which, as I say, really different
rhythm to
Good Time.
Again, this is one I don't think it got much of a wide release. That has changed now. It's coming back into cinemas, I think.
Oh, really?
But, yeah, directorial debut from Francis Lee, who's a Yorkshire filmmaker. I'm from Yorkshire, so there was kind of like this nice connection for me of going to cinema and seeing where I come from on the big screen, and it's not portrayed as this horrible, miserable place, which every other film about Yorkshire seems to do. And it's this love story between a young farmer and the man who comes to sort of help him out, the immigrant. And it's really, like, really beautifully shot, really simple, really sort of stripped back. Nothing sort of feels contrived about it. Two amazing performances from the lead actors who kind of, like, it is basically a lot of the time just them sat in fields. So, you know, they kind of have to do a lot of work and portray these really sort of men who've grown up not talking about their feelings, not communicating with each other, with anyone really. And you felt like you were watching something special. You felt like it was a story that isn't told in cinema. You know, same-sex love stories still, even to this day, like, it's 2017, there still aren't a lot of them. This year has been pretty good, but God's Own Country, yeah, for me, it just felt like really sort of transformative, and not just like a same-sex love story, just a love story.
Yeah, it's not an issue film particularly, but it's a tremendously organic telling of it, the way he just essentially plants all the elements and you just watch them kind of unfold in real time. Amazing film. Adam?
Yeah, thumbs up from me.
No, all right, super. Lovely. All right, well, David, you're up next.
Sure.
Two films from you. David Jenkins, films of the year.
The first film is, in fact, I think it's kind of interesting. We talk, like Edgar talking about this idea of these original movies that have kind of transcended the shackles of the franchise in 2017. And we've had Get Out and Baby Driver. And I think Girls Trip is actually another one of these films that was massively successful beyond any expectation.
Mm. So far, we've agreed on everything in this podcast. I think everyone's been pretty much on board with every film choice.
Yeah.
So one of your films of the year is Girls Trip.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of like, you know, singing from the heart here, I think.
Right.
I didn't go and see a press preview of it, and frankly, I hadn't planned to see the film, but a bunch of people went to see it. And when we got our own review in from a reviewer in the States who'd covered it for us, who was just, you know, surprisingly waxing very lyrical about it. And it was a case of I was wandering around on a, like Hannah and Baby Driver, I was wandering around on a Sunday on Holloway Road, as you do, and it was on, and I was just like, I'm just going to watch this, and was there with my wife, and we took it in, and it was an absolute hoot. And it's about these four kind of high school friends. They have kind of retained their relationship over the years, but they obviously have changed over the years, and they decide to go to this kind of fashion and lifestyle festival in New Orleans, and they're also there on a bit of a kind of drink up, and their various kind of, you know, they have little sort of scrapes and falling outs, and they kind of come to a head. And two things to mention, I think, is that you have Jada Pinkett Smith, and in I think it was 2015 or 2016 she had a role in the film Magic Mike XXL.
Oh, she was so good in that.
And when I saw that film, I was like, she's surely got to win some kind of award for that role, like Best Supporting Actor. And it was just, you know, tumbleweeds on that front. So I was really upset, but very glad to see her in this film again, as good, proving that wasn't just a sort of one-off with Magic Mike. But the real kind of top trump here is this actor who I'd never heard of her before, called Tiffany Haddish. And, I mean, it's literally like nothing you've ever seen. I mean, every single syllable she utters manages to be hilarious. There is something kind of in her bones that is funny. I don't know if you had this experience when I remember watching Ghostbusters as a kid. I just always wanted Bill Murray to be on the screen, like, because like whatever he did in the film, the sort of the camera would gravitate towards him, and you'd kind of, you'd anticipate something funny was about to happen, even if it was just through some small facial expression or how he reacts to someone else saying something. And I think she has a kind of like, it's that kind of level of greatness in this film.
So. It's a surprise choice, but you said it really well.
Yeah, it's really, really funny.
Can I get a second opinion? Has anyone else seen
it? It is very good. I would say the grapefruit scene is a highlight for me.
Oh, yeah, there's a very good grapefruit scene, and there's a very good scene involving a bizarre kind of like zip line between two bars on Bourbon Street in New Orleans, which stops in the middle and with hilarious results. And my second choice is Call Me By Your Name, Luca Guadagnino. The sort of adaptation of the novel by Andre Ackman. It's a kind of summertime gay love story set sometime in the 80s, and it stars Armie Hammer and Timothy Chalamet. It's basically this kind of Italian country garden, and Armie Hammer arrives over there as an intern, and he, you know, has this kind of affair with a younger boy. Well, it's actually, he doesn't have an affair. They very mutually fall in love together, and in a very kind of equal way. I saw this film like 3 times in the cinema because I just absolutely loved it. It's kind of strange in that it is this idea about this kid who's having a kind of boring summer, and all of a sudden something happens, and it's all automatically like enlivened and electric and very, very life affirming. And I think the film is kind of similar in that way, in that it's quite a slow build-up where you're sort of not quite sure what's happening, and you're kind of loping around, wondering where this is going to go. And then all of a sudden, it just, there's a point where it just locks into place.
It was a big cover feature for
Little White Lies. Yeah, we had it on our cover.
Did everybody in the Little White Lies kind of organisation, was everybody as wild about it as you?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I don't want to speak for anyone else, but we did all go and see it together at Sony, and we all had a sort of like moment outside afterwards, which was very, very beautiful.
Well, I you guys covered it before I started at Little White Lies, but I went to see it at London Film Festival at like 8 a.m. on a Wednesday at the Odeon Leicester Square, which is not the nicest cinema in the world. And, you know, critic screening full of like absolutely packed to the rafters. And I absolutely loved it. It was just a magical film. I've not seen many things like it on the screen this year. And Sufjan Stevens, who's one of my all-time great favourite artists, does the soundtrack, and he wrote 2 songs for the film, which, again, like, absolutely beautiful. It's just, yeah, it's really, really magical. It's the only word I can use to describe it. Yeah.
It could have had Shia LaBeouf in it. Did you know that?
That's quite a thought.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. I think one of the things also that, the music is great. It uses music in, I guess, in a sort of very different way to how Edgar uses it in Baby Driver. Music kind of like will suddenly sort of fade into a scene and fade out at quite kind of random moments, but it's very strange use of music in that way, but it's kind of beautiful.
I also loved it.
You did?
Yeah. It was great. I've only seen it once, but I really enjoyed it.
Just the once?
I mean, I haven't had a chance to watch it a second time, but I will.
All right. Wow, an outstanding selection of films and Girls Trip so far.
Wow.
In this end of year roundup. What's Edgar Wright going to nominate for his films of the year? We'll discover after this. The filmmakers' films for 2017.
Well, I think it's been a really good year, actually. I've seen, like, most of the sort of end-of-year movies. The Shape of Water, I think, is, like, really pretty extraordinary. And, you know, Guillermo del Toro working at the sort of peak of his powers. I like Phantom Thread, the Paul Thomas Anderson movie, which was filmed only blocks away from where we are right now. Which
really?
Is kind of crazy. It's in Fitzroy Square, most of that
is
movie.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay, it hasn't come out yet. As
it's actually like Paul Thomas Anderson making a British film. Really great, but Brits especially will enjoy scenes with Daniel Day-Lewis and Julia Davis together.
Yeah.
But it's sort of great, like, you know, it's funny sort of seeing him be like a British director. It's funny. Okay, my two picks are two films that I thought were pretty extraordinary is Raw, directed by Julia Ducournau. I think that's how you say her name. Ducournau. But a French horror film, directorial debut. I saw that at the cinema. I'd heard so much buzz about it, and I just heard about people fainting at festivals. But I also heard that it was really well directed, and it was one of those things where, like, you hear a lot of buzz about a movie, and it, like, really lived up to the hype. I thought it was, for a first film, it was really extraordinary, and it kind of, like, gave me vibes of, like, early Cronenberg, You know, it's about a girl that goes to medical school, veterinarian school, actually, trained to be a vet. And through her hazing, she's vegan, and through her hazing, she has to eat raw meat for the first time ever. And then she develops a taste for flesh. And it's one of those movies where it takes a sort of like a potentially schlocky kind of premise and, you know, treats it with real intelligence and even sensitivity. It's like one of those great horror films where you're completely on the heroine's side, even though she's like descending into kind of madness. And I always like those kind of horror films, whether you have things like Kronos or like George Romero's Martin or Carrie, even where, you know, it's sympathetic towards the person who's has the, you know, the problem. But I just thought it was like really, really confidently directed.
And this is a debut film. That's Jordan Peele's work. Is it easier in some ways to make your first film because almost perhaps because you don't know how difficult it's going to be? You're almost stronger in your vision than when you make the second one?
I don't know. I think there's just an alchemy at work because there's plenty of people's first films that are like not their best, you know. So it really depends.
I think was Shaun of the Dead your first?
I made a film 9 years before Shaun of the Dead called A Fistful of Fingers, and it is not my best film. I'd like to find a film fan out there that thinks it is my best. So I feel like Shaun of the Dead is my first film because I feel like it's the film that was closer to what I had in my head.
Right.
But, you know, then you get films like Get Out or Raw, which kind of seem to sort of arrive at the cinema fully formed.
Yeah.
And I just thought, I watched that movie and I was like, what is this person going to do next? This is incredible. And I saw it. It was not dissimilar to your Baby Driver experience. There was hardly anybody there, but the people who were going crazy. And there were lots of people on dates, and it has a couple of scenes which are like, you know, proper like cover your eyes stuff where the entire audience was like cringing down in their seats. But I highly recommend it. I thought it was like a fantastic movie, and I'll watch anything that she does after that.
Raw. And your other film, Edgar?
I got to talk about Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk, because I think sort of, again, talking about big studio movies and sort of like, you know, creative gambles, I think what's amazing about Dunkirk is like how sort of formally daring it is, especially for like a big sort of like Hollywood summer movie and a, you know, movie that, you know, I think grossed, I don't know, like sort of 150 million or more maybe. I love the fact that it connected with audiences and it was a big hit, because I think what is fascinating about it is that it takes a more kind of experiential, clinical approach to it. That it's a very different movie from, like, say, Saving Private Ryan, which is a movie that has that incredible opening and then sort of settles into being like a more conventional movie. Still very good and amazing, amazing sequences in it. But what I liked about Dunkirk, and I've heard this said as criticism of the movie, but I love this aspect, is that you don't find out any backstory about any of the characters. You're just like sort of dropped in there with these guys. And really the whole premise of the movie is to show you like what a like a hellish like 3 days this is. Actually, maybe it's like a week, a day and an hour. Yeah. That's it. The land part is a week. Mm-hmm. The sea part is a day and the air part is an hour. You have the three different timelines non-linear. Mm. For the sort of first two acts of the movie, and then in the third act it all goes into real time. And that's some really like clever like sort of structural work. I thought it was amazing. I really like sort of was kind of blown away by it, and by stripping out some of the war movie stuff that you have in every other movie, the point where somebody says about their girl back home, or like talks about, you know, bonds with people, and most of those things are gone, you know, and it's a lot sort of, it's, and as such, it's a colder movie. But I thought that was great. Like a movie made by a big Hollywood studio that feels very European to me. So I thought that was an amazing movie.
I saw this movie recently called Darkest Hour.
Oh, yeah.
Which has got Gary Oldman as Churchill. And it plays like the kind of bits that you'd have expected Dunkirk to have in it, the politicians moving things across maps and things like that, because it's happening, it's basically the kind of the inauguration of Churchill and the run-up to Dunkirk and that making that decision. So they're very, very different films, but it's interesting, like, watching them as a double bill. You know, with Darkest Hour, you don't see any fighting, you know, seconds, like, as kind of montage. But then Dunkirk's obviously the opposite, where you get no context. And I love the fact that there's no context.
Is Darkest Hour good?
I mean, I wasn't that taken. Like, Gary Oldman's amazing, yeah. I will say. But yeah, it's, for me, it felt like a certain type of British film.
Right.
Not my sort of cup of tea, maybe.
Mm. I think the thing that I liked about Dunkirk was that it did feel like something I hadn't seen before, which Christopher Nolan, you know, time and time again proves that he can just take this idea and totally flip it on its head. It kind of introduced me to the excellent Barry Keoghan, that's his name, who wasn't in it very much, but then did Killing of a Sacred Deer, which is also great.
He's as nice in Dunkirk as he's nasty in Killing of a Sacred Deer.
Yeah, he's so earnest and sweet in Dunkirk, and then, yeah, Killing of a Sacred Deer. But yeah, it kind of introduced this new raft of like young British talent, which is really nice. And then, of course, you have people like Kenneth Branagh and Tom Hardy in it as well, and Mark Rylance, of course. So there's kind of marrying of like the new and old, which is really nice.
I also quite appreciate that Harry Styles in it was like not a nice guy.
Yeah,
I thought that was great. That was a great idea, like of having him in it. He looks like Jack Wilde, Harry Styles.
Yeah.
Like, I sort of got an Artful Dodger like aspect of that. But I thought it was a great piece of casting where, like, he wasn't the nicest guy in the... He was, like, the, you know...
He wasn't just the kid from One Direction, which was really nice. Because I was a bit cynical. And then sort of, no. Actually pretty smart.
There were no song and dance numbers, which I was disappointed about.
It's a deleted scene where the other four got bombed.
Killing of a Sacred Deer, that would be... If we had a list of other films that...
That would definitely be on
there. That would be in there, although I know it didn't go down... It's so well with everybody. I'd have had
The Beguiled in there as well.
The Beguiled, yeah. Interesting.
I would like to stick up for Mother as well. That would actually be on my list. I'm one of the people who are a big supporter of Mother!
Best comedy of the year, though.
Listen, I think it is funny. I thought it was a black comedy.
Yeah, I'm not even... Yeah, I really liked it.
I say it's a comedy just by the fact it has an exclamation mark like Airplane and Top Secret. I saw it at Venice. That was another film that was at Venice. And... You know, it's interesting. I was in the first screening of that movie, and it was an amazing thing to witness because you could sort of see like differing reactions happening in real time in the audience of people that were loving it but horrified, or like me, like laughing quite a lot, and other people who were not on board at all. I mean, it's obviously a divisive movie, but I think it's really another one that's like, especially for a Hollywood studio movie, like really bold. To be that, you know, take the audience on a ride like that. And I sort of thought, like, middle America is going to, like, not be on board with this movie and where it goes. So I got to hand it to Darren Aronofsky. Like, he always kind of goes all in every time he makes a movie.
And props to Jennifer Lawrence, because, yeah, I can't see many young actresses taking a role like that.
Mm. Well, they're no longer together, which I think ties
I think
in
she
nicely
watched
with
it.
The...
Yeah.
What other films would you throw in then for a must-see list of 2017? I'd want to stick up for Logan, which I loved.
Oh, yeah.
Earlier on. And The Big Sick as well.
The Big Sick, yeah.
Florida Project. My Life as a Courgette. Did you catch
that? Oh, yeah. I thought that was a film from last year, but I like that movie a lot. Mm. In the States, it was called My Life as a Zucchini.
Of course.
That movie is great. The Big Sick is fantastic.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, talking about titles, Camille and Emily, I so sound like such a name dropper, but it's true. They are very good friends of mine. I live near them in Los Angeles. But they had sort of struggled with that title the whole time. I'd seen the movie and they said, we got stuck on this title, The Big Sick. And they had like a list of like 100 other titles. And I was trying to help them come up with another title. And then it just stuck. And then it's just one of those titles that's just like sticky. It's like you remember it.
Mm.
The first time they asked me, they said, what do you think of the title, The Big Sick? And I said, it sounds like a Michael Moore documentary. But it was one of those things that it kind of, now you can't think of that film being called anything else. It's like sometimes if it's a sticky title, whether it's like good or bad, it just helps.
I like titles where you have to kind of watch the film to find out why it's called.
Yeah.
Mm. Like Get Out is another one. I mean, I almost think it's a sort of... not a spoiler title, it's a sort of half spoiler title because it means you watch the film.
Yeah.
I hadn't even seen the trailer, which actually does reveal a key kind of twist in the film. So when it happened, when the thing in the film happens, I was just like, what? You know?
I will say as well for The Big Sick, really good cinema dad there from Ray Romano.
Oh, yeah.
Same in Call Me By Your Name, Michael Stuhlbarg on Top Form.
He's
a great dad, isn't
he? Great cinema dad, yeah.
Yeah. Magnificent, right. Well, that's 2017. Bosch. Anything in particular we should be keeping our eyes open for in 2018?
There's two that I mentioned already. Is Shape of Water out already? No.
It's not out here yet,
Shape of Water, it's Phantom Thread, Foxtrot, Jessica Lagarde. There's four, like, 2018 releases, rather.
I'm very excited to see Wes Anderson's Isle of Dogs, stop-motion animation in this sort of mould of Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Super. 2018, with a lot to look forward to. That wraps it up then for this edition of Truth and Movies, but we will be returning in the new year. Many thanks to Edgar Wright for joining us today. Hannah, David, Adam, and you for listening in. Enjoy your festive period in the meantime. This has been a 7 Digital production.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.